17. Corey painstakingly attached the last flesh depth marker on a cast of the first skull, glanced at the clock, precisely 5 p.m., then stood back to admire her handiwork. At John Jay College of Criminal Justice, she'd graduated with a simultaneous BS/MA in criminal justice with a specialty in forensic anthropology and facial reconstruction. Usually, it took a team of two to reconstruct a face from a skull, a forensic anthropologist and an artist. But she had studied both disciplines and was qualified to do an entire facial reconstruction by herself. It was a painstaking process involving both craft and art. Computer simulations, despite what was shown on TV, were just not as good as what could be accomplished by careful reconstruction working by hand. Of course, Lathrop knew nothing about this, having graduated a million years ago and never making any attempt to keep up with the field. She couldn't wait for him to retire. But here he was, busying himself with nothing while she warmed up a block of plasticine in a bowl of water over a Bunsen burner, getting ready to sculpt the muscles on the skull cast.
"Knock, knock," said Morwood, leaning in the doorway.
"Come in," cried Lathrop, rushing over to shift some boxes away from the entry.
"We're making brilliant progress, Agent Morwood."
Corey waited, saying nothing, while Lathrop led Morwood over to the work table. Corey decided to let Lathrop go ahead and talk all he wanted. She was tired of trying to compete with him, and besides, she felt confident that Morwood would see through it.
"As you can see," Lathrop said, "we've made a cast of the male skull, and now we're about to lay on the muscles and flesh, and give this poor victim a face, and hopefully a name."
"Very nice," said Morwood,
bending over her skull with a sidelong glance at Corey that spoke volumes.
"Nice work indeed. Any chance you'll get that ID soon?"
Morwood had looked at Corey while asking the question, but Lathrop forged ahead anyway.
"Without doubt. We also have dental records. Some rather odd dentistry, actually. The male had four crowns made not of gold, or even the silver amalgam typical of the time, but rather stainless steel."
The composition of the crown material was something else Corey had discovered on her own. Morwood raised his eyebrows.
"How unusual is that?"
"Most unusual," said Lathrop quickly.
"That should help pinpoint where the dental work was done, shouldn't it?"
Morwood asked Corey directly.
"Quite possibly, sir," she said quietly.
Abruptly, Morwood was taken by a brief fit of coughing. Then he cleared his throat.
"May I make a suggestion? Why not send those four crowns to the main lab in Quantico? They have world-class specialists in dental forensics."
"An excellent idea," said Lathrop. "Although, unfortunately, no prints remained for us to match against the databases. We've sent off DNA for sequencing. I'm quite confident, Agent Morwood, that we'll soon be able to identify both individuals."
"I'd like you both to present this at our weekly meeting next Tuesday. Think you'll have an ID by then?"
"Yes,"
said Lathrop, even as Corey said, "No." Morwood looked at each of them in turn.
"Which is it?"
"The DNA sequencing," said Corey, "won't be done by then. The dental work might lead somewhere, but I doubt we'll know by Tuesday. That only leaves the facial reconstructions. But they date back over 70 years, so it's unlikely anyone's alive to recognize them. It'll take some time to match them with existing photographs, if we can do it at all."
"Agent Morwood," said Lathrop, in an ingratiating tone, "I'm rather more sanguine than our resident Cassandra here. On the contrary, I believe we will have an ID for you by Tuesday, or at least something close."
Morwood nodded, and as his eyes flickered again to Corey, she thought she caught a veiled warning.
He knew how offended she must be, and he was cautioning her not to react. She swallowed hard. Our resident Cassandra here. Was she really going to let that one go?
You're both doing a fine job, Morwood said. Corey, as the agent in charge, I'll expect you to give the main presentation. I hope you won't mind, Dr. Lathrop.
He nodded curtly. Of course not.
Very good.
Morwood looked at his watch.
I have to go. The good Dr. Eastchester has granted me a 7 o'clock audience at his home in Los Alamos.
And he left. A long silence ensued. Corey made a decision. She turned to Lathrop and said, in a low, even voice, I did not appreciate your Cassandra comment. If you make another remark like that, I'll file a complaint.
Oh, what rubbish, he said. There was nothing wrong with my comment. Cassandra, as you apparently don't know, was the ancient prophetess who spoke the truth and was never believed. So, you see, my dear, it wasn't an insult. It was a compliment.
This little speech confounded Corey, but she nevertheless felt sure she had been insulted. The "my dear" didn't help.
It isn't just the Cassandra comment. It's everything since I first arrived.
She tried to speak in a measured tone, choosing her words carefully.
You've minimized and belittled my contributions. You've taken credit for things you didn't do, and you've treated me in a condescending and, frankly, sexist manner.
Well, well, huffed Lathrop. I didn't realize you were such a tender creature.
This is the FBI, my dear, not the DAR.
That did it. Corey lanced him with narrowed eyes.
Here's something you seem to forget. Not only do I outrank you as a special agent, but I am far more educated in forensic science than you. I doubt you've cracked a book on the subject in 20 years.
All the color drained from Lathrop's face, and Corey realized she had scored a direct hit. Her feelings of triumph, however, quickly gave way to apprehension as she saw just how hurt he was. She suddenly wished she could take back what she had just said. His face as white as a slab of suet, Lathrop stiffly walked away and exited via the lab door, closing it ever so fussily behind him.
18. The GPS on Special Agent Morwood's phone informed him to go left at the intersection of Trinity and Oppenheimer. He made the turn, marveling at the street names in this once secret town that had launched the atomic age. He soon arrived at 122 Oppenheimer Drive, a modest condo painted gray with white trim, and parked the car in a designated spot in front, next to an antique pickup truck. He fetched the large evidence container by its handles out of the back seat and carried it to the entrance. But before he could even ring the bell, Angus Eastchester had opened the door. Years had passed since Morwood had first met him as a rookie agent, but the scientist had aged gracefully, sporting a shock of white Einsteinian hair, a ruddy face, horn-rimmed glasses, and an appropriately rumpled tweed jacket with leather patches. He was leaning on a beautiful old Malacca cane with a gold head.
Please, come in, Eastchester said. Come in!
Morwood followed him into a modest living room. Eastchester offered him a seat in a wing chair that had seen better days. Morwood was surprised a Nobel laureate lived in such simple, even Spartan surroundings. Didn't a couple of $1 million come with the prize? Some people just didn't care about money or possessions.
Thank you for agreeing to see me, Dr. Eastchester, Morwood said. Let's get one thing straight, Eastchester said. I'm Angus, and you're Hale. No need for formalities here. Of course, said Morwood.
Eastchester was still as warm and unpretentious as he'd been 23 years ago, before he'd won his Nobel. It didn't seem to have changed him.
Before we begin, can I offer you anything? Coffee? Tea? Water? I'd love some coffee.
It had been a long drive from Albuquerque to Los Alamos, and Morwood needed refreshing.
Me too.
Eastchester called,
Annie!
A matronly woman came out of the kitchen.
Coffee, please.
Coming right up.
She vanished again.
When I hit 80,
said Eastchester, nodding toward the kitchen,
my children imposed someone upon me to help out during the day. I broke a hip last year, and it hasn't been easy. I'm sorry to hear that. Bah, the infirmities of age. What a bore. We gain honors, age, and wealth. And then, just when we're ready to enjoy them, Father Time comes swooping down and screws up our bodies. Pulvis et umbra sumus, and all that. I know what you mean. I've got this damn lung situation, which slows me down. I hear you're a supervisory agent these days. You've come a long way, Hale, from the nervous rookie I recall working his first case with that senior agent. What was his name? Mickey Starr. A case that's still open, unfortunately. It rankles. I can imagine it would.
The coffee arrived in an elegant silver coffee set, and Morwood took his cup gratefully, adding cream and two lumps of sugar. He stirred and took a long, satisfying pull.
Now that we're fortified, said Eastchester, let's have a look at this mysterious thing you brought. Of course.
Morwood slipped on a pair of latex gloves, placed the box on the coffee table, and unlatched it. He took the object out with his gloved hands and laid it on the table. A look of complete astonishment bloomed on Eastchester's face, and he exhaled abruptly.
My, my, he said. Where did you get that? You know what it is? Would you mind turning it over, please?
Morwood complied. Eastchester looked at it carefully, then sat back, shaking his head.
If I'm not mistaken, it's a highly classified component of the early H-bombs, known as a dial-a-yield. Which is? That will take a little explaining. As you may know, a hydrogen bomb gets most of its energy from the fusing of hydrogen into helium. That reaction requires so much heat and pressure, it must be initiated by an atomic explosion. The H-bomb is essentially a fission bomb that employs plutonium, which then triggers a fusion reaction in a mass of hydrogen right next to it.
Morwood wasn't sure he understood, but he let Eastchester go on without interruption.
H-bombs don't use normal hydrogen. Eastchester continued. They use an isotope called tritium, also written as 3H. You see that symbol printed on the side? It's a form of hydrogen that has two extra neutrons in its nucleus. Right. This device stores the tritium inside the bomb. You can change the yield of the bomb, in this case from 1 to 20 megatons, just by turning that dial. That device feeds either more or less tritium into the reaction chamber ahead of detonation. The more tritium, the bigger the explosion. Hence the name dial-a-yield. If you want to bomb Moscow, say, you might want to crank it up to 20 megatons to take out the entire city. If, on the other hand, you're bombing an airfield or a factory, a measly 1 megaton would suffice. Ghastly calculations, said Morwood. Without doubt, the Russians have had similar devices in their H-bombs. It's still classified? Very.
He leaned forward.
Can I ask where the heck you got this? It's a rather strange story. And it has to remain confidential. Of course. There's an eccentric billionaire, fellow named Lucas Tappan. The satellite and green energy fellow. Right. He's also into UFOs, and he's leading an archaeological investigation of the Roswell site, where that UFO was supposed to have crashed in 1947.
Eastchester's bushy eyebrows shot up.
Digging up the Roswell site? How perverse. During the initial survey, the archaeologists doing the field work found a grave a few hundred yards from the site. Two bodies were buried in it, along with that device. They were a man and a woman, both homicide victims, bearing signs of torture, followed by execution. Good Lord, have you identified them? Not yet. For a moment, however, I thought they might be the two scientists who vanished from Los Alamos in 1947. Those spies, Hedley and Warshinsky, who some say defected to the Soviet Union. Others, including me, think they might have been murdered. Except one of these bodies belonged to a woman, so it clearly wasn't them. Los Alamos was a secret city back then, Eastchester said. Everyone leaving was thoroughly searched. I wonder how this device got smuggled out. That would be no easy thing. But, Hale, it makes me think. Could it be connected with that unsolved case you worked on as a rookie? The murder of our nuclear scientist in 1999? Not possible. Those two bodies recently found at Roswell long predate the 1999 case. Of course.
Eastchester frowned, his brow creasing in thought, lips pursed. A silence gathered in the room. He then said,
May I?
Gesturing at the device.
If you don't mind slipping these on.
Morwood took a spare pair of gloves from his pocket and handed them over. Eastchester pulled them on, then picked up the device and examined it closely, turning it this way and that.
This is definitely of LANL making. Rather early one, I would think. What do you intend to do with it? We have a secure storage area for classified evidence. Now that you've explained what it is, it'll go in there when we've finished examining it.
He nodded.
Good.
He turned it over.
It looks almost brand new. There's not much rain out there in the desert, and it was buried 3 feet down.
Eastchester gingerly placed the device back on the table and peeled off his gloves.
You've certainly got a mystery on your hands, my government friend. UFOs, spies, torture, murder, H-bombs. Hell, when you retire, you can write a novel about it.
19. Nora peeked in the lab door of Quonset 1. It was 7 in the evening, the sun was setting, and the lab was dim and quiet. Everyone had gone back to their quarters to get ready for their dinner shift, except for one. She could see Tappan in the back of the lab, in a pool of light, bending over one of the tables. When he heard her enter, he straightened up.
Nora!
His voice echoed in the empty space.
Thanks for agreeing to see me at this late hour. Lock the door, please.
Nora shut the door and turned the bolt. She was curious what he wanted to show her. He'd been closeted in the lab with Greg Banks most of the afternoon, and when Banks emerged, the man had been completely silent and gone straight off to his trailer.
Come around the table. I want to show you something.
He was dressed in a black collarless shirt, open-necked, and jeans, and she was immediately struck by the suppressed energy radiating from him. She walked around the table, on which a number of charts were spread out.
You've seen these before, right, Nora?
Of course. They're mass spectrometry charts.
Good. I've got a little problem for you.
He pulled a sheet from the top of the pile and slid it in front of her.
Take a look at this one.
Nora examined the vertical bar graph. It showed the fingerprint of some chemical compound she didn't recognize, quite complicated, displaying dozens of vertical bars of different heights across various elemental masses.
See anything unusual?
She looked closer and then noticed that to the far right of the graph was a vertical bar way out on the atomic scale.
You've got an error here, she said, pointing to the bar.
An error?
Well, it shows an atomic mass that's impossibly high.
Impossible? What if I told you that Banks ran these mass spectra no less than 5 times with 5 different samples and got the same reading every time?
Nora shook her head.
I'm not a chemist, so maybe I'm missing something, but that mass is too high for any known element.
Known element. Greg Banks thinks it's a super heavy element that no one has seen before.
She looked at him quizzically.
I spent the afternoon with Greg trying to figure out the molecular structure from these spectra. He tells me they appear to be similar to an oxide of the rare metals yttrium and palladium, with hydrogen cations. Except that the palladium has been replaced by this unknown super-heavy element.
I'm afraid my physics is a little rusty, Nora said.
He swiped his hand through his hair and went on.
The atomic number of uranium is 92. That means it has 92 protons in its nucleus. Hydrogen has 1, helium has 2, and so forth. But every element beyond uranium can only be created in the lab, not in nature. As you go up the scale of atomic numbers beyond uranium, the elements get heavier and heavier, and they become increasingly unstable and short-lived. The atoms just fly apart. They have names like americium, berkelium, einsteinium, moscovium, all the way up to number 118, oganessen. That element was only confirmed in 2002, and it lasts for just 1/500th of a second before decaying into something else.
As he spoke, Tappan began pacing, his long legs taking big strides, then pivoting and walking and pivoting again.
But here's the weird thing. Physicists believe that a little farther up the periodic table, around element 120 or so, there's an island of stability, a cluster of elements that don't decay right away. They last a long time, possibly millions of years.
He stopped in front of Nora, and she could feel his excitement.
That bar you thought was an error? It's not. It's a super heavy element. It's element 126, in fact, because it has 126 protons in its nucleus. It also has 184 neutrons. Both of those numbers, 184 neutrons and 126 protons, are called magic numbers by physicists because they exactly fill electron shells. That is what gives this element 126 its remarkable stability.
Nora listened, becoming increasingly spellbound.
The bottom line is this. Even though we know element 126 can theoretically exist, we can't make it. It's too difficult. We don't have an accelerator with enough energy, and we don't have the right ingredients. It is technologically beyond human science.
He paused.
But here it is. It looks like someone was able to make it. My question to you, Nora, is who?
Nora hesitated. Aliens, she said, half jokingly. He gazed at her a long time and then smiled, his dimples appearing.
You said it, not me.
Nora tried to absorb this. In combination with the microtectites they'd discovered, this appeared to leave little room for doubt. This was indeed the crash site of an advanced extraterrestrial ship. She found herself breathing hard, her heart accelerating. Little room for doubt. And yet she realized she was clinging to that doubt with something like desperation. A part of her, she now understood, was simply not ready to accept a conclusion, however obvious, that would alter her perception of the world so significantly.
Her storm of confusion wasn't due to this discovery alone. It was, in part, because of the closeness of Tappan's physical presence. The intensification of her heartbeat, the tingling feeling in her limbs, the scent of his excitement. These were things she hadn't felt in a long time. But Tappan seemed oblivious. He was too intoxicated with the discovery, it seemed, to think of anything else. She took a deep breath and stepped back.
"And there's something else," Tappan said. "Even more important. That yttrium-palladium hydron compound I mentioned earlier? It's almost a room-temperature superconductor."
"That's not possible."
"Then you know what I'm getting at. Something that conducts electricity at room temperature without resistance. We've been trying to make such a material for 50 years. It would revolutionize everything from computing to energy transmission. But in this compound, element 126 is substituted for palladium, and it appears to be a room temperature superconductor, the holy grail of materials science."
He stepped forward and gripped her shoulders.
"Nora, this nails it. This is the proof we've been looking for. This is an alloy that could only have been engineered by a technology far more advanced than ours. Alien technology."
As his hands gently held her, she tried to keep focus. Extraordinary conclusions, she tried to tell herself, required extraordinary evidence, and there was always a danger when people wanted very badly to believe something. He embraced her shoulders for a while as silence fell. Then he dropped his hands.
"Nora, you're not saying anything. What do you think?"
"I'm..." She halted. His glowing face and shining gray eyes, so close to hers, were becoming increasingly distracting.
"I'm impressed," she finally said, weakly.
He laughed.
"Impressed? That's all?
Give me a chance to process it."
"Of course, of course. God, I must sound like a fanatic."
He waved it all away with a sweep of his hand.
"But you do realize what this means, right?"
She fell silent.
"You're a natural skeptic. I get it. But as I said, we ran 5 independent tests on 5 samples. All came up with that same super-heavy elemental line, way out there alone on the MZ axis."
"Which layers did the samples come from?" Nora finally asked.
"The beginning of the trench, where the object first struck the ground at high velocity. Whatever plowed into the sand shed that substance."
A silence fell as Tappan began gathering up the charts.
"I'm going to lock these in my safe. I'd like to keep this under wraps for now."
"Wait, you're not going to tell the group?" Nora asked. His smile went away.
"Not yet."
"Why?" Now the smile returned.
"Because, Nora, I hope to win you over first. You're the skeptic I want to convert."
Suddenly he looked at his watch.
"Good God, it's long past my martini hour. Would you care to join me? This calls for a celebration."
Nora felt herself blush at the invitation, even if it was harmless, because the thoughts that unexpectedly came into her own head were not quite so innocent. She hoped it wasn't obvious.
"No thanks, it's been a long day." "Of course, of course. A maybe is fine for now. But I'm going to get you to yes before long. I promise."
20. Skip, in the process of giving Mitty his evening walk, watched Nora go off to Quonset 1. As he turned to take the dog back to the trailer, he was approached by Baton. Twilight gathered over the immense landscape, and the first star had appeared in the west. Actually, Skip thought, not a star, but a planet. Venus, setting just behind the sun.
"Got a minute?"
Baton said. His voice was hushed, confidential.
"Sure. Let's take a walk."
Baton led Skip away from the encampment, walking quickly on his short, stubby legs. A fragrant spring breeze swept across the mesa,
carrying with it the scent of dust and some mysterious blooming desert flower. Mitty followed them eagerly. They walked perhaps a quarter of a mile, then Baton abruptly stopped and turned back toward the encampment, nodding in its direction.
What do you see?
Skip wondered if this was a trick question.
Nothing, really. Just some lights.
Precisely, Baton said.
We've been walking for just 5 minutes and covered, what, maybe several hundred meters? But already, that dig is little more than a few gleams against the horizon.
Skip nodded.
People are funny creatures, Baton said. Even the most intelligent of them, of us, are so easily swayed by self-deception. Here we are, talking about the Fermi paradox, the billions of planets teeming with potential life. But do you know something? This kind of talk is done mostly to reassure ourselves.
I'm not sure I follow, Skip replied.
We've walked such a short way, yet we can't see the dig site. How many molecules of Earth lie between it and us, do you think? Even this landscape, on a scale we basically understand, is staggeringly large. Can we truly comprehend the vastness of the cosmos? No. So scientists talk about parsecs and astronomical units and light years because labels and measurements are comforting. We invent labels because when we use them, it makes us believe we understand what's really out there.
I see what you mean, Skip said. That's what humans do. We label, categorize, measure, and dissect because it gives us the illusion of control.
Baton's eyes gleamed in the dying light.
I had a feeling you'd understand, Skip. What are your thoughts?
Baton hesitated, and Skip had the strong sense he was about to be confided in.
About alien abductions.
This wasn't the confidence Skip had expected. He paused a moment, then chose his words carefully.
I think some of them probably happened. Of course, some are just crazy people looking for attention. But some of the stories the abductees tell are just too grounded, too credible.
Now a long silence ensued, and then Baton said,
"Those are my thoughts exactly."
Another, still longer silence.
Skip, may I speak to you in absolute confidence about something never to be repeated to anyone?
Of course.
Skip could hardly believe a world-famous scientist was speaking to him like this. He felt a flush of warmth.
You remind me of my own son, Azriel, who was killed in the 2014 Gaza War. So very curious, so full of theories. Half of the questions you ask, you answer even before they're out of your mouth.
He went silent a moment.
Are you familiar with the Golan Heights? Isn't it the plateau that separates Israel from Syria? That's correct. It was occupied by Israel during the 67 war. Israel retained it as protection, because Syria was shelling Israel from those heights. It is high and rugged and gets snow in the winter. It's barely inhabited.
Skip listened to Baton's low voice in the growing darkness, inflected with a pleasing Hebrew accent.
As you probably know, most Israelis have to do a year of mandatory military service. I was no exception. Back in 1998, part of my national service was patrolling the heights. I was a member of a small patrol. Our platoon leader divided us up for an exercise, and I got separated from the others in a place called Einotzion, a very remote ridge in the foothills of Mount Hermon.
He paused to take a deep breath. Skip listened intently.
Toward midnight, I realized I was completely lost. So I settled down to spend the night on a ridgetop where I had a view all around, keeping on the lookout for the lights of my patrol. I fell asleep. A few hours later, I suddenly woke to find myself in a bright, warm beam of light. I jumped up, thinking it was a search helicopter, but lost my footing and fell upward. Yes, I know that sounds strange. A moment later, I was inside a glowing, circular room, lying on a slab of iridescent material. Emerging from the glow came five alien creatures. Humanoid in form, slender and gentle in their movements. They surrounded me. At the same time, I felt an incredible sense of peace, belonging, and oneness with these beings.
Skip, hardly breathing, could tell this was no perverse joke. Baton was telling the truth, or at least his recollection of it.
My memory becomes hazy after this point. I was examined, and they communicated with me. What they said had a profound and life-changing effect.
Again he paused. Night had fallen, and a limitless dome of stars had begun to appear over their heads like so much glowing dust.
What they told me was this, that they belonged to a galaxy-wide civilization of immense technological advancement, peace, prosperity, compassion, and happiness. The problems we face here, they had all solved. And one day, we would be invited to join them if we could cure ourselves of war, racism, inequality, and the other social ills of our time. I asked them, "Why me?" And they answered, "You will eventually understand. You are part of the plan." And then I felt like I was falling again, and found myself on the Einotzion Ridge. Dawn was creeping up in the eastern sky. A few hours later, my patrol came into view, coming up the ridge looking for me. I then did a foolish thing. As soon as I had the opportunity, I took the patrol leader aside. He was a lieutenant in the IDF, and told him what had happened. He was aghast. He immediately assumed I was psychotic, and said he was obliged to report me for my own safety and the safety of my fellow soldiers. It was only with extreme difficulty that I was able to quickly backpedal, retract it all, claim it was a dream, and talk him out of reporting it. If he had, I would have been cashiered. It would have gone on my record that I was mentally unfit, and my life would have been ruined. It was a lesson learned. For those reasons, I never spoke of it again, save to my son.
His voice had fallen to a hush. Skip had to lean close to hear him.
It did, however, encourage me to pursue a path in life, the one you're familiar with from my books and research. But I kept that encounter to myself, because if it ever got out, it would all be over for me. Even here and now, perhaps even among these open-minded scientists, I would be thought a crank. Yes, of course, I understand. You must tell no one, not even your sister. This is between you and me.
Then he smiled and glanced at the dog.
And Midi. I promise. For me, this project is more than just a scientific effort. It has spiritual significance. This discovery will draw us closer to the day when humanity can cast aside its evil ways and eventually join the galactic civilization.
Skip felt a shiver of exultation. This was an incredible revelation, and Baton, the famous scientist, had chosen to make it to him, and him alone.
"Thank you," Skip said into a long silence. "Thank you for your trust and confidence in me. I had a purpose in telling you." "What is that?"
Skip said eagerly. Baton laughed out loud, grabbed Skip by the shoulder, and gave him a friendly squeeze.
"All in good time. And now, let's go find out what our friend Antonetti has on this evening's menu."
21. Hale Morwood pulled himself out of the driver's seat of his black Cadillac XT6, waited for a moment to catch his breath in the night air, took out the box with the dial yield, then locked the SUV's door with his key fob. He began walking from the employee lot toward the entrance to the FBI building. It was a few minutes before midnight, and the night was dark and moonless, reducing the buildings in the nearby business park to low rectangles of light. He wasn't a big fan of Cadillacs, or American-made cars in general, but he'd chosen the Caddy for the same reasons he'd picked an obnoxious, decaled pickup for his work vehicle. It didn't look 5-0. It offered good protection in the case of a collision, and, perhaps most important, it took little effort to slip in and out of. Morwood approached the front of the three-story central structure and went in through the main entrance. He signed in, exchanged brief pleasantries with the night guard, then walked with measured cadence to the elevator bank. The doors opened, he stepped in, and instead of heading up to his second-floor office, he pushed the button marked B and waited for the lift to take its usual sweet time. At least the slow ride to the basement restored his normal respiration, such as it was. It was quiet down here, no surprise given the hour. He turned left down the hallway, dimly lit since half the overhead lights automatically shut off after 10, and started for the lab. 20 paces. The distance, long memorized, rose to his mind whether he wanted it to or not. The only advantage to an enforced sedentary lifestyle was that it gave him all the time he wanted, and then some, to indulge in his private passion. History. Specifically, American military history. In recent years, he had read avidly and deeply. He could specify, down to the regiment or squadron, or sometimes even the company, what turned the tide of battle at places as diverse as Bunker Hill, Gettysburg, or Midway. Although reserved by nature, he rarely put such erudition on display. In particular, he was fascinated by the technical aspects of war, and how developments such as the rifled barrel and Norden bombsight could play as much of a role in victory as courage or strategy did. He reached the door to the lab, and alone and unobserved, paused to take a few breaths. His armchair avocation had occasionally helped in his investigative work. More than once, lying in bed and unable to sleep, his mind drifting over some detail of Thermopylae or World War I, he would find, among the litter of chaos and death, some insight into an elusive case he'd been tasked with. He would jot his thoughts down on a pad, and then check on them when he went into work the next day. Normally, they didn't pan out. Now and then, however, they started a chain of mental dominoes falling. Such a thought had occurred to him this evening, and he jotted down the particulars as usual. But he hadn't gone to bed. He believed this particular revelation couldn't wait for the morning. He pressed the keypad, and the lab door unlocked with a hiss of escaping air. It was almost pitch black inside, of course, with only the red exit signs for light. He stepped in, felt around with his hand for the bank of switches, flicked them on. Ahead lay the usual rat's nest of unopened shipping boxes Lathrop allowed to pile up, lining both walls and obscuring the view of the main lab around a corner and to the left. The place stank, too. All forensic labs stank, to various degrees, of chemicals and fluids and decaying things. But this was worse than the others of Morwood's acquaintance. There was a vague aroma of food, reminiscent of liverwurst, that in this context was revolting. He understood why Corey didn't like working with Lathrop. Not only was he an old fuss budget, but he kept his lab in vile condition. He reminded himself to send out a gentle memo to that effect in the morning. He stepped forward, past the stacks of boxes, toward the bend in the passage. Ahead, he could make out the shadowy set of light switches that would illuminate the lab itself. He found himself smiling at the thought of Corey. She had a special kind of moxie, not studied or forced, but a natural instinct to lower her head and charge that. There was a blur of motion, gray upon black, in his peripheral vision. It was so rapid that, secure location or not, All Morwood's instincts shouted danger. He began to turn, but fast as lightning a hand slipped up beneath his arm, then seized the back of his head in a half-Nelson as solid as iron. Morwood opened his mouth to yell, dropping the box while at the same time raising his elbow to strike back at his attacker. But this move was anticipated, and he felt himself shoved violently forward against a metal packing shelf. As he choked, the wind knocked out of him, Morwood felt the burning sensation of a needle being driven into his neck, at the scalp line. Abruptly, the vice-like grip slid away, freeing him. Regaining his breath, Morwood turned, preparing to launch himself at the intruder. But even as he did, he felt a peculiar weakness shiver down his spine and then out to his limbs. His muscles grew slack, then, with horrible rapidity, unresponsive. His legs gave out and he crumpled to the floor, unable even to stop his head from slamming against the concrete. He was paralyzed, unable to move, unable to work his jaw or even blink his eyes. As he lay there, dazed by the blow to his head and the suddenness of his attack, he noticed the rest of the lights coming on. A moment later, a figure came into view, looking down at him. A man in his 30s or 40s with chestnut-colored hair. He was wearing a dark, conservative suit of the kind favored by the FBI. Morwood, frozen, saw an expression of both curiosity and concern on the man's face. He knelt and placed two fingers briefly against Morwood's neck. Then the man raised a latex-gloved hand and, very gently, closed Morwood's eyes. As he lay, immobilized yet fully aware of his surroundings, Morwood heard the man's footsteps recede into the deeper spaces of the lab. But the man and his sudden attack were already less critical to him than they'd been a minute before. The paralysis had now spread to Morwood's pleural cavity, and his breathing, a burden at the best of times, turned into shallow gasps. Having satisfied himself that Agent Morwood was no longer a threat, Lime glanced around the laboratory. The compound he'd injected Morwood with, similar to vecuronium bromide in its paralyzing effects, but undetectable in an autopsy, would do its work in 15 to 20 minutes, perhaps less, given the man's already labored breathing. His preparations were almost complete. Timing should not be a problem, if he hurried. He moved toward a black bag of ballistic nylon lying unzipped atop one of the metal examination tables, rummaged inside, and removed a few small tools and a sealed baggie containing what looked like brown, oversized grains of rice. Rat shit, to be specific. Then he walked over to a far corner of the lab, used a step stool to reach and unscrew a grill near the ceiling, and, balancing a pen light on the cavity within, began working quickly but efficiently. Within 8 minutes, he was done. The grill and step stool back in their places, and the latter wiped clean of any footprints. Lime glanced at his watch. He was on time, and the preparations were almost complete. Just one more thing. A small screwdriver appeared in his hand, and he went to a battered round machine sitting in a dusty corner, the lab's autoclave. Working with speed and efficiency, he knelt and unscrewed a metal plate in the side of the machine. Setting the plate aside, he reached in with a penknife and worked for all of 20 seconds, then he placed the plate back on and screwed it into place. Finally, he double-checked everything, a mental checklist exercise he had been conditioned to perform. He walked over to the door through which Morwood had entered, made sure it was securely closed and that its automatic lock re-engaged. Then he returned to Morwood, motionless on the floor. Kneeling once again, he determined the agent was now fully unconscious, his body still struggling to breathe, but well on its way to death. That, at least, was a mercy. Although the drug was Lime's preferred method for such business, suffocation by paralysis was an unpleasant way to go. Still, smoke had to be found in the man's lungs. It was a shame, really. Everything he knew about Morwood, based on the man's official dossier, would have made him a good candidate. Certainly, his character, beliefs, and outlook were in line with the Atropos Creed. It was his unfortunate medical condition that had disqualified him from being approached. More quickly now, Lime went through Morwood's pockets. He riffled through his wallet, checked his keys, then replaced both. There was a folded piece of notepaper with his wallet that he checked, glanced at its contents, then replaced it as well. Rule 7. Whenever possible, take nothing, leave nothing. A muffled popping sound from the autoclave signaled that his operation was now underway. A moment later, this was confirmed by an acrid smell of smoke. Rising, Lime returned to the examination table that held his bag. He dropped his tools into it, made one more quick but thorough check of the lab, and then, with a rapidity born of familiarity, Lime removed his jacket and trousers and turned them inside out, revealing linings of black felt. He put them on again, then pulled a balaclava from the bag and rolled it down over his head. Smoke was now quickly filling the room, but there was no alarm, no drop-and-turn dance of the ceiling sprinkler heads. Satisfied, Lime zipped up the bag, slung it over his shoulder, and walked back to the shuttered loading dock and the small service door that stood beside it. The door was slightly ajar, just as he had left it. He paused at the jamb for one last moment, then slipped out into the night, closing the door to the lab behind him. Then he turned and, moving away from the scattered lights of the business park, disappeared quickly into the dark. 22. The cell phone rang so loud and abruptly that Corey jerked awake beneath the covers. Even in bed, she was still on edge. She'd felt restless and uneasy all evening, without knowing why, and tossed in bed for ages before finally drifting into a fitful doze. Sitting up on one elbow, she plucked the phone from her nightstand. It was 2:30. Shit, that meant she'd been asleep less than an hour. The caller ID came through as private, probably some robocall. Unbelievable. As she answered, she made a private promise to track down the bastard who owned the company responsible and drape his ballsack over her bathroom door.
"Yes,"
she said, hearing the sleepy croak of her own voice.
"Agent Swanson,"
came a male voice, urgent, abrupt. Something in the authoritative tone made her flash back for a second to a night a decade earlier, when a Kansas sheriff was beating on the door of the trailer she'd shared with her mother.
"Agent Swanson?"
the voice came again. Pushing the old memory from her head, she sat up and cleared her throat.
"Yes?
SAC Garcia here."
Garcia, head honcho of the Albuquerque field office. It was true Corey didn't see him very often, but nevertheless she knew his voice. The man on the other end of the line didn't sound like him.
"Yes, sir?"
I'm sorry to disturb you at this hour."
"That's all right, sir."
"I need to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. Can you please tell me when you last saw Agent Morwood?"
Corey's half-asleep daze made this question harder to answer than it should have been.
"This afternoon, sir. Yesterday afternoon, that is. He came by the forensics lab."
She heard a shuffling of paper.
"You were working on some facial reconstructions."
Garcia might not sound like his usual self, but he seemed remarkably awake and alert, given the hour.
"I was preparing to, yes."
"Do you happen to recall what time this was?"
Corey thought a moment. She was fully awake now, too, and increasingly alarmed by the direction these questions were taking.
"It would have been about 5:00, sir."
"And did he give you any indication of what he had planned for the rest of the day?"
He said he was going to see an old acquaintance, ask him about the device found at the Roswell site."
More shuffling of paper.
"That would be the scientist he mentioned. What was his name?"
"Eastchester."
"Very well,"
Garcia said.
"Any idea why he'd be in the forensic lab a few hours ago?"
"A few hours ago?"
Corey paused. There was a low babble of voices in the background. Where was he calling from?
he might have been returning the device he checked out to show Eastchester.
Yes, of course.
Sir, would you please tell me what these questions are about?
It was several moments before Garcia continued.
There was a fire in the lab tonight. A serious fire.
What?
Corey began. Her mind raced.
In the lab?
I'm very sorry to inform you that Agent Morwood perished in that fire.
What?
Corey blurted again, not even trying to restrain the sudden spike in her voice.
The investigation has just started. I'll know more tomorrow.
Corey, stunned into silence, did not reply. The babble of voices on the other end of the call grew louder.
I need to hang up now. I'm very sorry, Corey. I know how much you respected him. This is a shock to you, to all of us. We'll talk again in the morning.
Wait!
Corey shouted abruptly, but Garcia had already terminated the call, and she found herself crying into a dead phone.